Good afternoon. This is Nevin Campanella welcoming you to the BBS production of Woodland Star, your net radio source for entertainment and coincidental enlightenment. And I guess I should talk a little bit about what the hell do I mean about coincidental enlightenment. I have had a few comments. It does not mean that you are going to somehow evolve spiritually, mentally, physically, or any other which way. No, coincidental enlightenment, for me, what that means in this show is every once in a while, I'm going to point out the frauds and scams regarding spirituality. So be prepared. Now, if you do happen to get enlightened by something I present in the way of material, great. But what I mean by it is there's a lot of BS going on the net when it comes to spirituality. And every time I find it, I'm going to uncover it. That's what coincidental enlightenment is all about. And as far as entertainment, well, some people will agree with me, some people will disagree with me. There's hot opinions, cold opinions, and all kinds of opinions in between. And that's the entertainment part. What is this show really about, Woodland Star? First of all, the very format of this show over time will be primarily research in the area of primarily metaphysical. Not always, but that will be primarily the format of the show. Every once in a while, I will have a guest, but I'm not reaching out for guests. Not at all. I have done that in the past. I did that on What a World Radio, which was a great show. I enjoyed it. But on this show, which has had kind of a bumpy start, I have decided that I'm going to make it my mission in life to scour the net, trying to find things that you can actually use in your everyday world to develop. To develop your talent and your skill in creating within your own personal life space. Now, next week, I am going to have a guest, and his name is Vincent C. Beach. Mr. Beach is 82 years old, originally from Jamaica, and he'll be on the show to tell us his story of how he created his own reality as a black child growing up in hardship in Jamaica, going to England, eventually coming to the United States, and we will cover all of that on November the 11th. So please do tune in. Don't tune out, though. As Timothy Leary once said, tune in and drop out. Toll-free numbers, if you want to call in. If we have a listener out there, I'm sure my brother-in-law is listening. Let's see, toll-free number, 877-270-8714. That's for the United States, by the way. And we have a toll-free number for Canada, which is 888-228-4494. You know, it's hard for me to say the word Canada without actually thinking about a very pristine environment. I just love Canada. And if I ever had a choice, wow. You know, if it wasn't for that darn cold weather up there, it is so beautiful, folks. It really is. Okay, where are we today? On Jane Roberts and the Seth material. Now, I will return back to this material on November 11th. Again, November 4th, we're having a guest, Vincent Beach. I probably should spend a little bit of time reviewing what has gone on so far. You know, folks, this material, it's real. 21 years worth of channeling, Obsessed by Jane Roberts. We're talking about a mountain, literally a mountain of material. And all of it is, by the way, available at Yale. You can go to the library in Yale, and all her notes and documents and whatever she did, it's all there. Unfortunately, I do not have the resources to travel there. If I did, believe me, I would spend a few months researching that material. Her husband, Robert Butts, donated, just after her death, he donated all the material to Yale University. By the way, I really haven't mentioned this before, but Robert Butts is also an accomplished artist. And for those who are curious, you might want to see a painting he did of Seth. In all honesty, I don't know how he managed the painting, but it was somehow done as a description between Jane's comments and how he interpreted them, and he comes up with a portrait of Seth. Very interesting. Well, a little bit of background. Where are we at? First of all, number one, we create our own reality. Now, that one comment is kind of like the foundation, the absolute foundation of all the Seth material. And you will hear Seth in his books, you will read Seth stating that very thing that he says, I know that I state over and over again this one concept, you create your own reality, but that is the truth of existence. What else have we learned? Well, probably the most profound statement is, quote, you're as dead as you're going to get, end quote. I actually wrote that one time. I made a sign, and I that's all that was on a sign. You're as dead as you're going to get. I was living in Alma, New Mexico, in a campground, and I hung it up outside. I used to raise racing pigeons, white Belgians, as a matter of fact, and I put that sign right on the pigeon coat. You would be amazed at how many people that would come into the campground and just were totally baffled by that statement. As a matter of fact, if my favorite producer is listening, you're as dead as you're going to get, I'd like to suggest to him that he put that at the top of the index page for BBS Radio, because, folks, it's true. It is absolutely and literally true. Life and death are simply part of existence. Life is one state, death is another. And, of course, when Seth is talking about death, what he's talking about is passage, you know, from that body to something else. That's what he means by dead. You're as dead as you're going to get because what he's saying is there's no such thing as death as you understand it, you know, the end of things. No, nothing ends. That's another thing that we have learned. Nothing ends. God, all that is in constant transformation, constantly changing. And we need to talk about that for a second. Because Seth talks about, quote, all that is, end quote. That's the God concept. And it's a gestalt of all of existence, as in pantheism. And everything in existence is part of that gestalt. Now, please keep in mind, there's two words that could become very confusing. There's pantheism, which is what Seth is referring to, all that is, the gestalt, everything is God. Your cigarette lighter, your thoughts, your neighbor next door, the hair on your cat's head. As opposed to another word called panentheism. You gotta keep these two separated. Because panentheism, while it sort of refers to a God concept as a gestalt, it also suggests that there is an identifiable source beyond that gestalt. It exists separate from it. That is not Seth material. For Seth, all that is exactly that. Everything and anything you can think of. Pantheism. Don't confuse it with the word pan-en-theism. There are some interesting notes from Jane's classes. Now, Jane held ESP classes, I think, twice a week. And you will be able to find some of the notes, and I'll probably go over some of them today, from some of her students. The sad part about this is that I'm talking about material that actually kind of came to a screeching halt around 1983. Jane died in 1984. And so the people that were connected to Jane are sort of dying out. What is really unfortunate about all of this material, and I just had a little bit of discussion with my producer, Don Newsom. The Jane Roberts and the Seth material is not promoted on the net. It is really, really difficult to get very much. What's sad is that the Seth material is probably the only true, really reliable channeled material. I mean, it is literally the foundation. And by the way, the statement, we create our own reality, comes from Seth back in 1963, 64, somewhere around in there. You'll read about it in the book, Seth Speaks. But that statement comes off of the Ouija board back in December 3rd, 1963. A little bit more background, the things that I have covered, just to kind of summarize. Jane actually began receiving some sort of information in September of 1963. She was writing a book on ESP. This was not a lady who was involved in channeling or anything like that. She was simply interested in some of these metaphysical paranormal events. And, you know, ESP was kind of exciting. So she was attempting to write a book on it. It was in September of 1963 when she was just writing some notes. And all of a sudden, this voice, whatever, pops into her head. Now, historically, you're going to read in the records, such as in Wikipedia, that it begins in December 3rd of 1963 with a Ouija board. That is quite correct in terms of Seth identifying himself as an entity. But her actual, ability, talent to receive this other type of information actually occurred a couple of months before, back in September. She, you know, Jane was an extremely private person, and so was her husband. Unfortunately, there's not a whole lot of material about her private life. And she was tenacious in keeping her life separate from the material she channeled. And she was very clear when she would say to people, look, this is what I hear, this is what comes to me. Now it's up to you to decide its worth, its validity. And she wasn't always, you know, all that trusting of it. Matter of fact, there's an incident in which Seth suggested no vaccinations, and this kind of knocked her for a loop. Keep in mind, Jane never really heard Seth, or I should say, remembered what she said. It was all done in a trance state. So her husband, Bob, had to relate back to her what she said. And he was great about the note-taking. He took all his notes in his own type of Robert Butts shorthand. He did record once in a while, but it was rare. She sat down, a cigarette in one hand, a bottle of beer in the other, and boom, off she'd go into a trance, and Seth would come through, and he would write down everything that she said. One of the more interesting aspects of the Seth material, and I did not know this until recently, was that there was, in fact, a second Seth, which they is referred to very quickly, but it's simply called Seth 2. And where are you going to find this? Well, you're not going to find it in any of the books that she had written, not that I could find. It comes from, this information comes directly from one of her students in her ESP classes. And it's really kind of buried in his own notes. I uncovered it, and all he says is everybody in the class was just astounded that all of a sudden this other Seth, he refers to him as Seth 2, came through. And he says he's kind of humorless and had a completely different personality than Seth, or I should say Seth 1. You know, I really wish I had the resources to travel back to Yale to go through all this material. You probably could spend a lifetime doing it. I would love to spend a year back there. It's too bad, the federal government spends an awful lot of money on all kinds of bullshit and some pretty strange grants. I wish I could get a grant to get Jill and I back to Yale University so that we can do this research and actually start promoting it on the net. It needs to be done. If there's anybody out there that knows of a resource where money could be put together, or in fact, even other researchers, but people better than me, I'm not all that great, this material needs to be really broadcasted. It really does. I'm doing what I can, but there is so much. I mean, it's like trying to untangle sometimes literally a bowl of cooked spaghetti. There's just so much material, you don't know where to start. Some sort of group maybe needs to be put together. Maybe a group back there that can visit Yale every day, do this for a year, pull this information out, and while they're constructing, you construct a website where this information can go on and out to the public. Well, that kind of catches us up. I left off that the statement by Seth, quote, "You create your reality according to your beliefs and expectations. Therefore, you should examine these carefully. If you do not like some aspect of your world, then examine your own expectations." Well, that's where we're going to start tonight. What Seth is saying is that everything that happens to you happens because of your expectations. Or, another way of saying it, what you believe. You know, the word belief and expectation sometimes are kind of interchangeable. You have an expectation of something because you believe in a particular way. So I'm kind of saying you might have to go a little step further back than just expectation and get into the belief system itself. And how does that belief system affect you in terms of you creating your own reality? Now, in order to establish a real clear path towards creating your own reality, you have to understand those parts of the self, the greater self, the you, that contribute or inhibit this learning process. Now, according to Seth, the self is a composition and a gestalt of many, many different pieces of things. These pieces often were created beyond the original self and got added into the system. Remember the story of Billy the Cat and Jane's cat had died, and Seth went on to say, that cat, Billy, went on as a consciousness, changed focus, and along with his litter mates, developed into a gestalt of another consciousness. So things are under kind of like constant creation, constant change, if you will. These are tricky terms to use. Well, let's take a look at the most common beliefs, or as Seth states, examine our beliefs and expectations and see how they might contribute or detract from creating your own reality. Well, the first place to start, at least for myself, is if you're going to look at the self, you have to first start out with some assumptions regarding the nature of the universe and how you fit into it. Everybody makes assumptions at some level. This is called, you know, the existential journey, the existential question. You know, we kind of like all sit around studying our navel, like where is God, where is the end of the universe, is there a God, if not, why not, and so on and so forth. But there really are a couple of assumptions you're likely to make. No matter what you say at a coffee shop or, sitting around with some friends, having a good time, regardless of what comes out of your mouth, you have made some assumptions. Well, what kind of assumptions could you possibly make? There's not very many. Not very many. Some groundwork to that assumption as to how you approach it in creating your own reality, you are going to have to let go of the victim mentality. You know, if you're the kind of person that is constantly walking around saying, he did this to me, or they did that to me, or this SOB did this, what, you know, and you got this constant victim style about you. Now, you've encountered people like that. You know, they suck you dry when you talk to them. They're kind of like emotional vampires. If you can't let go of the victim mentality, you're not going to get anywhere with creating your own reality. You really got to drop that one. Another thing that you have to drop are the self-fulfilling prophecies. You know, the ones that stop you in your tracks, like, I can't do this. Get rid of the word can't. Now, if you can let go of the victim mentality and drop the word can't from your vocabulary, you can start a process of coming to an understanding of your beliefs and assumptions regarding the nature of the universe and how you fit into it. You can actually sit down and take a look at what you believe and then redecide how you want to approach it. Do you really want to continue believing it? Well, the very first question to ask is, one, what do I believe about my existence? Who and what am I? And do I actually exist? Sound a little strange? No, not at all. Those are the existential questions. Do you really exist? It's kind of an age-old question, actually, and has a long history connected to it. If you want to get to those assumptions about what you believe, you have to get a real path to understanding those parts of the self that contribute that learning process. The very first step is to get a handle on all of it, and you do a bit of analysis regarding your existence. In a sense, you attempt to define the self, what you are. Well, what are you? We're trying to find those assumptions regarding expectations and beliefs, and we have to have a starting point of some sort. So you start with, well, what am I? Well, at the mundane level of existence, the most obvious question regarding the self is, am I my brain? Are you your brain? Am I my brain? In other words, I got this mass of stuff up in my cranium called the brain. And I have been led to believe by many, many people on this planet that I am my brain. That whatever it is that my brain does, that's me. And you know what? It almost makes logical sense. Think about it. Your common state of awareness suggests that you're a consciousness sitting somewhere behind a set of eyeballs located within the skull. And so since that's also the housing of the brain, a conclusion of I am my brain certainly is not surprising. You know, when you think about it, you're like right now, if those who are listening, you are listening where? Well, through your ears, connected to the skull, again, the information flowing in and out and thinking and all that all seems to be a consciousness at the top level of the body. So it kind of makes logical sense to arrive at a conclusion that you are, in fact, your brain. But are you? Ah, this is the part that some people don't want you to understand. Now look, the brain is an absolutely magnificent switching mechanism. And this organ is capable of receiving and sending information at a complexity level and speed that can't be duplicated by any modern computer. I mean, this is a pretty amazing organ. My second most favorite organ. However, it has a little problem. Brain can't do a damn thing without you. That's right. You know, if you take you out, talking about death now, you leave. Your consciousness is gone, wherever, whatever. The brain no longer functions. What happens when we stimulate different areas of the brain? It's fascinating. And I have actually been involved in some of that type of research using animals. Years ago, I was a graduate student. I worked my way through my graduate degrees as a lab assistant. And so I did a lot of work with lab rats and rhesus monkeys. I also was subjected, I should say, here I am using victim mode. I also experienced a lot of classroom information on what happens with stimulation of the human brain. Well, you can go find it on the net yourself, and you will see immediately that as different areas of the brain are stimulated, a very light current, it stimulates sensory experience or memories. Yeah, that's right. In other words, you take a very mild electrical charge, and I'm talking really mild here, you know, not something that would burn a piece of paper. Once the different areas are stimulated, memories come back to the individual. Now, how do we know that? We know it because the person gives you a report. As you are stimulating that brain, the person is talking to you. There's no pain involved, and the person is quite awake. And so when they do these studies, the person is simply reporting back to the experimenter, hey, I'm thinking of this now. Well, wow, do that again. It was a great orgasm I had, and so on and so forth. As you stimulate different areas of the brain, you get different sensory experience, different memories. But you know what you can't do? You cannot put a slice of brain under a microscope and find these events. Nope, it's just not there. There's nothing to look at. Synapses is what you'll see. Now, synaptic connection. I'm talking about the neurons in the brain. Now, they attach to each other. don't quite actually touch. Okay? The transmission and reception of information via the brain is really not a mechanical process. And in fact, much to the chagrin of many people out there, it's not quite an electrical process either. It becomes an electrical process, but it's in fact begins with a chemical exchange across the synapse. So the chemistry changes across the synapse, the electrical charge then is created and goes down the neuron. But all the memories and sensory experiences and everything else under the sun that you've experienced, you can't find it in a slice of brain. One piece of brain looks just like another. It all looks the same. Oh, some neurons are longer. Some have a slightly different thickness of myelin sheath around them, but basically, they all pretty much look the same. There is an exchange of this chemical across the synapses, and all of a sudden, a person is reporting something to you. So we know that when we stimulate different areas, we get different events. Now, the most amazing part about this is that it's actually consistent between people in terms of location. And that's how we've been able to map the brain. Certain areas of the brain, when stimulated, seem to produce a certain type of experience or memory. And so brain mapping, in fact, has been done, and we have problem-solving areas and so on and so forth. And it is fairly consistent between people. This is the big one. There is nothing you can put under a microscope that will show any of these events. So if you can't find it under a microscope, if all you're looking at is the same damn chemical crossing the synapse, producing the electrical charge, then where the hell is the memory? What is it exactly? Why can't we find it? There's no simple answer. But I'm going to make a suggestion by way of an analogy. And this is going to fly in the face of everything else you've ever heard about the brain. The analogy is pretty simple, really. Take a battery-operated radio playing a music station, okay, and place it in the middle of a primitive village. Let's say you go down to South America and you find an extremely primitive village that has had almost no contact with the rest of civilization. So you place this radio that is playing music, okay? It's picking up from an AM station somewhere, maybe in New York, whatever, you know, it bounces off the stratosphere, so on and so forth. Now, the villagers gather around the music. If you ask the villagers, where is the music? What do you think they're going to do? They're going to point and tell you that it's in that thing, the radio. Well, the music is certainly coming out of the radio, but there's nothing stored there, is there? Nope. The radio is simply transmitting a signal from elsewhere. But it sure looks like the music is actually in the radio. Just like our brain looks as if it's storing data. But it's not. Nope. If thought were stored in the brain, then where the hell is it? Excuse me, if the thought is not stored in the brain, where the hell is it? I have no idea. And in fact, it may not be stored anywhere that we can describe as part of the third dimension. Now, a little side trip here on what you are, and are you in fact your brain? No, you're not your brain. Like I said, your brain is a switching mechanism. But in terms of a side trip, and where is it? Where is all that information? It's out there in the universe somewhere. It doesn't stop. Seth tells us this. Seth will tell you. Your thought continues at an infinite level. It doesn't stop. Every thought, every action, every activity continues on. How do you grasp it then? How do you grab hold of it? Well, you know, we did have a person in the United States called the Sleeping Prophet, Edgar Cayce. And when he did his thing as a, I don't know, a channeler of sorts, he always referred to this library of where he could go in a trance state, pull out information. Seth will tell you that everything is connected. One consciousness knows everything about another consciousness. They are all connected. It all communicates. Is there some sort of abstract library out there that is infinite and stores everything? I guess maybe in a sense there really is. But I don't think it's something that you could identify in terms of a form. In other words, you know, our tendency as humans is want to put walls around everything and compartmentalize everything. The memory, I believe, is the universe itself. It is just available. You don't have to be at any particular place because there is no such thing as place. That's a human thing. We think in terms of time and place. So we want to find a library with walls around and go pull out a record. Edgar Cayce used those expressions because back in 1930, 1940, he would have been hard put to talk about the things I'm talking about. No one would have had any idea of what the hell he was saying. They would have thought he was crazy. We can't talk about this in 2007. That the library is existence itself, and you have access to every part of existence immediately, without hesitation. Every part of it. You don't have to go anywhere. It's not a time thing. It's not a place thing. You simply have access to everything. Maybe we reach out to another form of existence that somehow stores abstract thought. And you know, even when I say that, it doesn't make any sense, because how can you store something when there is literally nothing to store in? See, things become confusing very quickly, because now we start getting into conversations about linearity, quantum physics. I mean, we don't have the language to describe some of these things. You sort of have an intuitive feel for what I might be saying. But to try to really describe it in using a language, it's really tough, because language immediately wants to put a form to everything. Where is it and when was it? Doesn't work that way. It allows, you know, when and where allows us to communicate at the mundane level, but it ain't worth a damn beyond that. It's very, very difficult to describe where is it. You'll have to take it simply as I'm saying it, and Seth will tell you this. It's everywhere. It's everything. It is pantheism. It is all that is. Now, if that boggles your little brain, you can't help it. About the only thing I'm absolutely sure of is that after death, the brain no longer functions. And if it did store information rather than just transmitting information, you'd think it would still be available after death. My conclusion? I am not my brain. Wow. Okay. So far, Seth and I are in agreement. And Seth will tell you the same thing. You know you're not your brain. Well, if I'm not Mike Brain, then what am I? What the hell is the composition of this self? Wait, you know, the only evidence that we have of something beyond the physical body, and I mean this, the only evidence, is that of self-awareness, thinking. That is the single aspect that you have of the self that we use to state our own existence. There is nothing else. Everything else has to be taken on sort of like third-party evidence. In other words, you go talk to someone and they tell you that something exists beyond the physical body. You have absolutely no way of going beyond the physical body except through your own self-awareness. Now, Seth did talk about four primary levels of existence: the physical, the dream state, the electrical, and then the fourth, the antimatter. And I got to be honest with you, when it comes to electrical and antimatter, I have absolutely no idea what the hell he's talking about. I can almost understand the electrical, but antimatter, that is way over my head. But we do know the physical, and we certainly do know the dream. The dream state. I suspect that we probably get a lot more information about our own existence in terms of that dream state of existence rather than this third dimensional physical state when we're awake. But it is really, it's only your self-awareness that you have to assert the fact of your existence. So what does that mean? Well, René Descartes, and you heard of René Descartes, I think, therefore I am, you know, cogito ergo sum. Well, the only reason he came up with that is because he said thought can't exist. My thought can't exist without me. Therefore, I exist. Well, you know what? That's kind of open to argument. And some people did argue. How does he know that his thought can't exist without him? Now, he's not talking about him in the physical. He's talking about him as consciousness. Also understand that Descartes actually gave up that line of reasoning. He really did. Because there was lots of arguments against it. Now, you're going to have to be a philosopher to understand most of it. But he did give it up. He gave it up in favor of simply, I believe I exist, therefore I am. He went to the, you know, the Seth thing, expectation, belief, expectation. He believes that he exists, therefore he exists. That's what he eventually concluded. And you're not going to see that very often in the books. Everybody really likes that kind of flowery statement. Cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. There's lots of little jokes about it and so on and so forth. But he did not finalize his own philosophy with that. No. He finalized his philosophy with, I believe I exist, therefore I do. Now, and what I'm saying to you is, this is your starting point. All you need is a belief of your existence. As far as I'm concerned, I have concluded you're not your brain. I have also concluded that I'm only not my brain. I also do exist simply because I believe it. Well, what can we do with it? I mean, is there any scientific evidence we can use to prove our existence? Nope, not really. About the only thing you can do is stick with the concept of you do have a self-awareness, and since you believe you exist, therefore you do, period, at the end. There's an aspect to Descartes, and he didn't delve too much into this, but, you know, there's a possibility of existence might be a function of not his belief, but rather belief by others. Now, this touches on Seth a little bit, and I'll get to that. It would be extremely difficult to ponder the reality of your own existence if there was nothing but you. That is, no sensory input whatsoever. Now, can you imagine what that would be like? I mean, there have been, or there used to be, many studies in sensory deprivation, but keep in mind that every study ever done in sensory deprivation always started with a subject who had experience with sensory input. So they, in other words, they knew what they were missing. But what if you existed without ever having experienced any sensory input? What would it be like? Could you conclude your own existence from that point? Wow, that's a toughie. I could, I don't know, I guess I think about it in terms of all that is, you know, I want to go to a starting point. I want to say that there was a time when all that is was not me, in the sense of this consciousness of me. I was there, but not as a separate consciousness. Believe me, I'm not exactly sure what I just said, but I seem to understand it for myself. Maybe, just maybe, if I can use the concept of time here, maybe there was a point in existence in which all that is had a desire for more, other than all that is. And so existence of consciousnesses is created because it thought in those terms, thereby providing entertainment. Yeah. I mean, think about what I had said before. What would your self-awareness be like if you never experienced sensory input? You had none. Well, maybe that's what it was like at one point in time. And out of sheer boredom, consciousnesses started fragmenting out to start experiencing things as a form of entertainment. Boy, you know, it's a rough one. It's a rough thought because it leaves a lot of questions open, but so does the concept of this is a learning experience. If you know, if you use that concept, it kind of suggests that someone wants you to learn. And I got to be truthful here. Seth actually does kind of make an inference that there is a system of sorts. And you're not going to develop out of the system until you learn this one real well, because somehow you're prevented from doing so. That suggests a hierarchy of some sort. I don't know where to go with that. Where does this all leave us? Do I exist? Do you exist? Well, why not just take a risk and say, hell yeah, I exist, and leave Descartes to ponder the question. So, what does this have to do with creating your own reality? Well, that is exactly what I just did. I created the reality of my own existence by my insistence. What we have pieced together so far, I exist simply because I say so. I am not my brain, and I am my self-awareness. Now, with that out of the way, I can now take on the task of asking myself some general questions regarding the, quote, cause of my existence, end quote. Now, in one sense, I have sort of answered the question when I said, I exist simply because I say so. There's an implication that I'm directly connected to the cause of my existence. But it's only an inference. And in order to get on with the business of creating my own reality, I have to take a stand regarding that cause. Without a solid foundation, the system I begin to develop has a high probability of falling apart due to doubt. Yeah, you know, folks, it's the doubt. It leads to confusion, mixed messages of desire. But most of all, it's a sense of being lost in a universe so damn big and expansive, you can't even begin to contemplate it. So you have to take a stand regarding your existence. You want to create your own reality? Time to take a stand. Now, the first three are pretty simple. I exist simply because I say so, I'm not my brain, and I am my self-awareness. That's no big deal. Take a stand on it. But there are two major assumptions you're going to have to take a look at if you want to come to terms with all of this. I call them a priori assumptions. Now, what is your a priori assumption regarding, quote, cause of your existence? A priori is actually a legal term. And it means deductive reasoning from some sort of general principle that's not supported by fact, such as a judgment of some sort. It's based on a hypothesis or theory rather than an experiment. It comes by way of logic, but there are no facts involved. So you make an a priori assumption about the cause of your existence. Well, since it is impossible to test for cause, I'm sort of stuck with making an assumption because that assumption has no observed facts. It is an a priori assumption. In law, an assumption is defined as an assumption that is true and no other proof is needed. But, you know, there is a caution to this, and that is an a priori assumption made without question, without analysis or study, can be just a result of mental laziness when the reality is not so certain. In other words, you're so damn lazy, you're not willing to dig in and do the work to find the answer. However, that really isn't the case here in terms of your existence and the cause of your existence. No analysis is possible, and you're in a constant state of belief without knowledge. It's a tricky place. It really is. You have two assumptions available. And we're going to be coming to the close of the show, but I'm going to give you those two assumptions. There really is only two. The first possible a priori assumption is that you're infinite. And this would translate into no first cause. In other words, you always were. Well, what do I mean by that? You know, if you go by the lines of the Seth material, what we're suggesting is that you, in fact, are part of all that is. Was your consciousness always there as the self? If we use the Seth material, it's doubtful. Now remember, I'm saying doubtful. Essentially, it means you always existed as part of all that is. So there was no first cause. You're infinite. Is your consciousness infinite? I think at one point I might have said yes to that, but I'm not so sure anymore. I think that consciousness itself, as a substructure of all that is, might have a beginning point. Now, the second possible a priori assumption is that you're finite. And this would suggest that you had some sort of beginning. Now, I'm not only talking about consciousness. I'm talking about your total self, that it never actually was part of anything. It wasn't part of that pantheism, okay? It was created from nothing. Therefore, you are absolutely finite. In other words, you had a true beginning. You weren't actually God. You weren't part of all that is. You were simply created. That's panentheism. So you've got two assumptions. Either you are infinite or you are finite. Pick one. Folks, that's the... We're arriving at the end of my 55 minutes. I'll pick up on all of this again on November 11th. Thank you for listening, and I wish all of you a wonderful day. That's a wrap, Don. I'm hanging up.